All right, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. You guys ready? Good stuff today coming up. We'll see how far we get. But we are on page 18, 18, 19. Can I do this in 90 seconds? Let's find out. Here's our recap, okay? The mitzvos, the commandments, no, take a step back. Creation is for the purpose of us drawing down godliness into the physical world. That's point one. How do we do that? We do that through the 613 commandments. That's point two. The 613 commandments represent the 248 divine organs of the king, the 365 veins and sinews. Negative commandments represent that dimension of the divine king. Parentheses, the divine king is not physical. It's not even, doesn't even have spiritual form. It's just terminology that we use in order for us to comprehend and relate to this process of divine channel being manifest downward. So that when we do a mitzvah, we bring down that dimension of godliness into the world. Point number four. The majority of the commandments take place in the land of Israel, are associated with the land of Israel. Sacrifices, agriculture, so on. And therefore, Israel is a holy place. Because if the whole purpose is to bring godliness into the world, and we are dependent on that divine energy in order to sustain ourselves and the world around us, the majority of that journey takes place through Israel. And that's why Israel is a holy place. Everything in the physical has its spiritual counterpart. So there's a Jerusalem, there's an Israel above, there's a Jerusalem above, there's a temple above. The spies didn't want to deal with the physical world. They didn't want to be engaged in all the challenges of the physical reality. So therefore, they wanted to accomplish the same thing, but they wanted to accomplish it in the spiritual realm. That is, they wanted to bring the manifestation of the core, which is Chachma, the first of the 10 Sephiros. They wanted to draw that down into the land of Israel above. The land of Israel above is Malchus, right? Malchus being the lowest of the 10 Sephiros, the four worlds, Atzilus, Bria, Yetzira, Asiya. They wanted to do it in the highest world, to bring the divine revelation that we understand goes from the top all the way down into this physical reality. They wanted to do it just in the spiritual world. And the reason why it's called Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel in their context, is because Shemayim, heaven, represents that which is higher. Eretz represents that which is lower. As we use the analogy that the earth is God's footstool. Hashemayim, Shemayim Kisi, the heaven is God's throne. The earth is God's footstool. That represents the idea of heaven being higher, earth being lower. And they wanted to accomplish that in the first of the four worlds, but totally in the spiritual realm. Yeah. So it's there like we are here. In other words, the physical reality is here right now, even if you're not doing a mitzvah. But its sustainability requires constant divine energy, as do the spiritual realms. So what happens when we do a mitzvah, as we'll learn a little bit maybe later today, is we actually draw the divine energy all the way through all the worlds into this physical reality. they didn't want to be involved down here. In other words, in their perception, if the objective is bringing divine energy into, is drawing down divine energy, it's adequate to do it in the spiritual realm. Why do we have to bring it into the physical reality? It's enough to do it in the spiritual realm. That was their approach. Obviously wrong, as we'll see it, why. But if you take a moment and think about it, let's try to see it in a positive light. There are many people of different faiths and different religions and different spiritual pathways that believe in, in divine engagement, specifically removed from physical consciousness. Many meditative practices actually require removal from a physical consciousness. It's not the Torah view, as we'll discuss. And as how do we know that? It's actually from this story, right? But the premise is there, the idea. And think about it on a very real level for ourselves even. In other words, this mistake is not, it's not so far out, right? When I actually spoke about this last night at Havdalah, that Shabbos, like, who doesn't love Shabbos? If you experience Shabbos even a little bit, let alone if you experience it fully, who wants to go back to the 6 days of the week? Like, you're removed from the physical reality of the world around you. You experience Shabbos. It's like, it's amazing, right? I don't want to get too psychological today, but right, we have much more awareness today around triggers and traumas, right? And then we have coping mechanisms. Just on a very basic level, what is a coping mechanism? A coping mechanism is a way to remove yourself from having to deal with the physical reality. I don't want to deal with my feelings, so therefore I'm going to engage in a coping mechanism. A coping mechanism could be retreat. Coping mechanism could be addiction. Coping mechanism sometimes is anger, blame, you know, all kinds of coping mechanisms. But what's the idea? The idea is I don't want to deal with this stuff, so therefore I'm going to do this stuff. I don't want to deal with the world, so I'm going to retreat. Spiritually, I don't want to deal with all the nonsense of the world. I guess all this stuff, I mean, who doesn't come out the end of a week and say, what did I spend? Like, this is nonsense. There's so much nonsense in the world, right? What happens when, God forbid, we have a tragedy like we had in Israel, right? You suddenly, like, everything becomes real for us. Like, you want to talk about that? You want to fight about that? Like, really? We got more serious issues. We have existential issues going on here. But again, it's all the same premise. There's all this physical stuff. There's all this physical nonsense that consumes us. As they said, it's a land that consumes its inhabitants. And who doesn't want to remove themselves? Now, if you dig deeper spiritually, okay, what they were trying to do actually makes a lot of sense. Let's just, if our job is to bring down divine light, great, let's do it up here. Let's bring divine light into the spiritual worlds. Why do we need to get involved in all this? This world, whatever, it's a passageway. I'll tell you the answer by way of a story that before we tell the answer here. I wonder if you were maybe even there. After 9/11, I think it might have been the Shabbos after 9/11, we did a Shabbat dinner. We actually did it at Sherith Israel's. This is right after we left Anshei Sfard, before we bought our building on Ponce. Or maybe we had already bought the building, but we needed a larger space. So we did a Shabbat dinner in Sherith Israel's annex over there. They had a preschool there or something. It was a pretty well-attended dinner. I think everybody was like looking for inspiration. Anyway, and I was young. I still am young, but I was really young then. I think I was like 20, how old was I? I was 27, 28. Anyway, and I was a little bit naive still. I got wise over time, but I was a little bit naive. And I was saying, like, all this moral equivalence that people were putting out there, like, I think it's worth exploring, right? What did they do? They were just people who believed in something and they were ready to sacrifice themselves for it, right? And okay, and we're willing to sacrifice ourselves for our faith. So I remember hearing a talk from Rabbi Manus Friedman at the time, and he said something that, like, he does these things. He like throws out like one-liners that you have to like really think about. And when you finally get it, it makes sense. Anyway, so he threw out a one-liner. He said, the reason that they're wrong is because they believe heaven is better than earth. They believe that heaven is better than earth. And because they believe that heaven is better than earth, so therefore, whatever they're doing down here is agendaized to something that is not the divine purpose. God put us on this earth because earth is better than heaven. And even though we're called upon sometimes to have self-sacrifice to the point that we give up our life, it's not because heaven's a better place, but because that's how the mission down here is fulfilled. I was actually thinking about it this past week where you know, thank God, this when they went in to save those two hostages, nobody got killed along the way. But within the same 24 hours, a number of soldiers were killed in other operations. And you start evaluating, like, is it worth saving hostages when other soldiers, even if soldiers would have, God forbid, been killed in the act, it still would have been correct. Why? Because we don't evaluate life against life. We evaluate right against wrong. And if our job is to go save someone, even if it means if somebody's life is in danger, you got to go try to save them, even if that puts your life in danger. Because that's the right thing to do. That's the moral thing to do, right? That's the upstanding thing to do. In other words, it's not about heaven. We're not trying to get to heaven. It's our job is to make this world a godly place, to make it a better place, to make it a more moral and upstanding place. And sometimes in that process, you have to have self-sacrifice. So their agenda was to bring the divine light into the spiritual worlds. They didn't want to engage in this world. Not because they thought that this world wasn't the right place, but they didn't want to get involved. They wanted to be removed. Did that answer your question? We forgot what the question was. Close enough. Okay. Now, it's they wanted to bring it down into the desert. Desert, midbar. In Hebrew is also the word dibur, speech. And speech is the level of malchus, the lowest of the 10 spheres, the level of malchus where they wanted to bring the divine light into is called speech. As we discussed, that the three intellectual, that we have 10 spheres, three intellectual, six primary emotions. And then malchus, the lowest of the spheres, is where that journey becomes manifest, ultimately in speech and action. But in this context, it's about speech. Midbar, desert is speech. That's where the process becomes revealed. Okay, so now we're going to continue on the bottom of page 19. V'ratzu ha-meraglim she'yiyu kol ha-mshachas michach mi'la l'b'chines dibur. Eretz Yisrael shelamayla. The spies wanted that all the divine revelations should be brought from the highest level, which is Chachma of Atzilus, right? Chachma of the highest of the four worlds. Don't bother yourself too much if you don't understand the spiritual roadmap specifically. It's not so critical. The main point here is that their intention was to duplicate the process that God was instructing them to do in Israel, in the physical Israel. They wanted to duplicate that process in heaven. They didn't want to bring it down into the reality. And what's that process? That process is bringing divine revelation from a high place to a low place. The high place here being a very high place, and the low place being a low place within the lowest within the highest of the spiritual world. That was their intention. They wanted to bring the manifestation of Chachma into the dimension of speech, which is, quote unquote, the land of Israel, which is above. Up there, in that spiritual realm, you also have the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, and you have Jerusalem. The Chol HaBechinas and all of the levels. All of the levels exist in heaven as they exist down here. In fact, the reason they exist down here is because they exist in heaven, right? They get channeled from heaven through the chain of creation until they show up in this physical reality. But in heaven, They're in a heavenly dimension, and in on earth, they're in a very physical reality, physical dimension. Let's read this paragraph, because I think it also just tweaks the point a little bit. The spies wanted that our service of Hashem should focus on revealing in Malchus of Atzilus its source, which is Chachma of Atzilus. Since they were on the level of connecting to Malchus of Atzilus, that's where they wanted all the revelations to come to. In other words, they operated in a different dimension. They were of a different dimension. And in that other dimension, they wanted to do whatever we do on this dimension in that dimension. Right? Think about a child. Two children playing. They're playing Legos. They're playing cars or whatever they're playing. These two kids, they're playing this game and they're communicating with each other. But they're doing it as five-year-olds. Two adults sit together at a table and they're talking Torah. They're also communicating with each other. But one's at a childish dimension and one's at an adult dimension. And the myriads of level in between. The spies were adults, spiritual adults in their perception. And because they had this high spiritual source, they wanted to do whatever the rest of us were being instructed to do. They wanted to do it in their dimension. And they felt that that was adequate. But they were mistaken. Why were they mistaken? Let's read this next two lines very, very carefully, because it carries such a powerful message. Aval Yehoshua v'Kalev amru tova ha'aretz ma'id ma'id. Joshua and Caleb, Yehoshua and Kalev, they were the two of the 10 of the 12 spies that did not come back with a negative report. They came back with a positive report. And when the other 10 spies spoke negatively about the land of Israel, their response was Tova Haaretz, the land is good, Ma'od Ma'od, which is a double expression. It's very, very good. It's very, very good. Why is it very, very good? Through the land of Israel, down here specifically, the physical land of Israel, which as we said is all about physical action-based mitzvahs, action-based commandments. Fred, do you mind grabbing the door? Thank you. Physical, action-based mitzvahs. What is the result of that? Yumshach b'chinas arein soif. The divine light, the infinite light, will be drawn down. Which dimension of the divine light? B'chinas ma'oid. The level of ma'oid, of very, very. Right? The level of very is going to be drawn down here. What does it mean, very? Very is beligvul. It's an infinite manifestation of the divine light. And very, very is bebechinas amen stimen v'amen dizgalion, into the hidden worlds and the revealed worlds. V'zeo ma'od ma'od, beiz pama ma'od. That's why they said the word ma'od exceedingly twice, very, very good, that it's going to be drawn down into the spiritual worlds and into the physical world. Let me read a few more lines and I'll kind of unpack this. Ki be'emes ikur kavanasi is baruch, she'yir dira betachtonim. Because in truth, what is God's main intent? God's main intent, God's primary intent, is to have a dwelling place here in the lowest world specifically. K'maimer azal, like our sages say, nisava kadosh baruch hu li is le'dira betachtonim. God desired to have a dwelling place in this world below, in this physical world below. And that should be revealed in the eyes of all flesh. In other words, physically, we should see God's home down here. And that is achieved specifically when you have the advantage of light when it comes through darkness. So let's unpack what's going on here. I'll start from the end and work back to the beginning. And I'll tell you a story first, which we heard yesterday. I'm going to tell it the way I heard it, different than we heard it yesterday. There's a rabbi from Australia of blessed memory, Rabbi Chaim Gutnick, who came to the United States, and he was going to visit Cleveland. He had a family celebration, a family simcha in Cleveland. And before he went, he had an audience with the Rebbe. And the Rebbe told him, there's a particular rabbi in Cleveland that is outspoken against me and my efforts. Did I tell this story recently here?
It's about 6-7 months.
Okay, so let's see if I'm consistent. Thank you. I thought I might have shared it at Kabbalah and Coffee. So the Rebbe said to him, go meet with this rabbi and find out what his issue is. So he goes and he meets with this rabbi. And the rabbi says, I have two issues. One is that whenever the Rebbe introduces these new mitzvah campaigns, he doesn't consult with us other rabbis, you know, rabbis like myself. He just goes and introduces new mitzvah campaigns. He says, that's number one. Number two, the passage on top of page 21, which he quotes from the Medrash, that the Holy One, blessed be He, desired to have a dwelling place in the lowest level, right, in this world below. This was the Rebbe's calling, his mantra that he shared from his first public talk. His whole first discourse is based on that passage from the Medrash, that God wanted to have a dwelling place in this world below, and therefore everything stems from there. Everything that we're doing is all about achieving this objective. So it's a Medrash, right? Medrash Tanchuma Nasai, chapter 16. Now, many people can quote chapter and verse Bible, right? Most of us can probably rattle off 30, 40, 50 commandments, right? Maybe we could even dip into some of the commandments that are no longer practiced today. But most Jews cannot quote chapter and verse where this Medrash comes from. So this rabbi said, the Rebbe took an obscure Medrash and made it into a whole path of Judaism. His whole Judaism is defined by this one obscure Medrash. So I don't understand it. Like, you want to know why I have a bone with the Rebbe? Because he doesn't consult with me. And because he took a random Medrash and defined his whole Judaism by it. So the Rebbe smiled, and the Rebbe said, he answered his first question with his second question. Somebody who doesn't see that the whole purpose of Judaism is to make a dwelling place for God in this world below, I can't consult with him about mitzvah campaigns. We don't speak the same language. So what is this all about? What does this mean? The rest of that conversation that the rabbi yesterday shared with us was about the Beatles, which was a cute story. But I want to verify the story that it actually happened, because before I start repeating it. But anyway, what is this Medrash? What is the meaning of this Medrash? Let's unpack the Medrash. When you come home, look, you came out today. Everybody, it's cold outside. You put on a sweater, you put on a jacket. If you're a little more of a chilly type, you put on a heavier coat. You have to contend with the world around you, right? You can't walk out in a bathing suit. I mean, you could, but you'd probably get arrested. People will definitely look at you funny. Now, so you have to put on clothing in order to function in the world. If you're going for a job interview, you show up in your Sunday clothing, you're probably, and it's a, you know, it's, it, it, I don't know, it's a professional position, a lawyer, an accountant. Also, they're not going to look at you too seriously, right? If you're going to work in dangerous chemicals, you need to have a hazmat suit. If you're dealing with airborne chemicals, you need to have a mask, right? That's the way it works. If you want to be part of the world, you got to put on clothing. But when you come home to your own house, okay, assuming you live with other people, maybe this doesn't work. But if you live alone at home, you come home and you do whatever you want. You take off your clothes. You listen to whatever music you want. You can say whatever you want. You can behave any way you'd like. It doesn't affect anybody. You can, just don't make too much noise to disturb the neighbors. But other than that, you can do whatever you want. You're at home, you're yourself, right? In a good relationship, when you have a healthy relationship, you're comfortable to be vulnerable. You're comfortable to be yourself. Why? Because you're at home. When you're at home, you don't have to put on any facades. You don't have to put on any ears. Just be. You can just be yourself. God created the world and he put on a lot of clothing. The world that God created is covered with clothing because we don't see God. If we look deeply and we think, we look with our brain, and sometimes we can look with our heart, we can say, I see the beauty of that piece of nature. It has a creator. Somebody brought this into being. Somebody brought this into being. How does that? There must be a creator that brought this into being. Sometimes in our lives, we experience a powerful moment, birth of a new child, marrying off a child. You experience some kind of, you know, quote unquote coincidence that just couldn't have happened by itself. And you see for a moment a glimpse of God. Or you come to services, you come to shul on Yom Kippur and you're fasting, and at once some moment you just feel this moment of revelation. But that these are moments. But in a usual going about our business, we don't see godliness. I'll take it even deeper. Actually, my wife and I had this conversation yesterday. So something happened yesterday, and I realized, like, I was very uncomfortable emotionally. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm thinking about this particular situation. I'm saying, like, I'm aware that I'm feeling envious of this particular situation. And I also know that intellectually, what I know about my relationship with God is that the envy is misplaced. And so we talked back and forth, and then we came to this conclusion that I'm a human being. We came to that conclusion. And human beings that are not tzaddikim, that are not of the righteous category, where they're in a perpetual state of divine consciousness, human beings are going to have emotions that are not necessarily the holiest emotions. Envy is an emotion. It is what it is. You don't have to beat yourself up that you're a human being. The question is, what do you do with that emotion? Do you act on it? Do you say, I'm envious, and therefore I'm going to go and hurt that other person? Or I'm going to go to try to take away the thing that I'm envious of? Or do you stop and say, yes, it's an emotion, and that's okay because I'm human, but I'm bigger than that. Meaning the godly soul, is bigger than the animal soul, and I don't have to get stuck there. What's going on? Why do I have to have this struggle? I have the struggle because God is concealed. The tzaddik, who's in a state of divine consciousness, doesn't have the same level of concealment. And therefore, because the tzaddik doesn't have that level of concealment, the tzaddik doesn't get these emotions. Because envy is based on a misunderstanding or a lack of seeing the divine presence. And that's why when we have those moments where we see God, so to speak, the garments have been removed for whatever reason. Maybe God just gives us that opportunity to have that glimpse. On Yom Kippur, for example, we are elevated. And one of the reasons that we fast is to help break down the body's resistance to seeing and experiencing godliness. So by virtue of that, we do become a little bit more in tune on Yom Kippur. And by the way, this is our journey of life, is to engage in prayer and to engage in Torah study and to engage in Shabbos observance and to keep kosher. The mitzvahs refine us so that when we do experience those physical things, those physical challenges, it is a little easier to plug into the divinity that's in that experience. Again, as long as we're on this earth until Mashiach comes, we're going to have the physical limitation. But the mitzvahs were given to refine us so that it'd be easier to plug into that. And by the way, each of us show up to the table with our own set of complex experiences that shape our own internal struggles. Right? No two people have the same mechanism. Each of us have our own unique genetic makeup. We're born into different homes, experience different upbringings, and therefore the things that are, so to speak, going to trigger us are going to be unique. But each of us also possesses a soul that can rise above that. So making a dwelling place for God in this world is helping God be at home. That's our job. Our job is to help God be at home. How do we do that? We say to God, oh, this is not just a cup of water. It's God's creation. Let me make a blessing. This is not just a physical experience of envy. It's a godly moment where I can allow godliness to define what I'm experiencing. As soon as I do that, I say, you're not irrelevant, God. You're totally relevant. You're relevant even in my deepest unhealthy emotions. You're also relevant. You're present. When I go to work and I bump up against the challenge, and I've mentioned this in the last little bit, a lot of people move, especially in today's culture, people go into victim mode. A victim is someone who God is not part of that equation. There's no victims when God's part of the equation. It's all part of the divine master plan. So if you bump into a situation at work, you bump into a situation in a relationship, and your response to that is to pause and say, hold on, God's here. This is being orchestrated. What's my job? What do I need to do here? How do I bring God into the consciousness of this experience? When we do that, we make God at home. And on its most physical level, going into the land of Israel and harvesting your crop and leaving the corner for the poor and tithing it and giving it to the Kohen and to the Levi, taking your animal sacrifice and bringing it to the temple and slaughtering it there and engaging in all of that practice. And all of the other physical mitzvahs that are connected to the land of Israel and beyond, in every mitzvah, there's an opportunity to say, God, you're here. That is Judaism. That's what it's been since the beginning of time. Judaism is about making God at home. And we do that through the 613 commandments and utilizing them to navigate whatever is going on inside of ourselves to bring a consciousness of God into the world. Now, can you compare the result of God feeling at home in a physical world that comes to recognize God? Can you compare that in any way to bringing godliness from the level of chachma in the world, in the highest of the worlds, to bring the revelation from the level of chachma into the level of malchus, into the lowest level of the highest world? If you can, think about it from God's vantage point. Where does God feel, wow, now I really feel at home? When he goes from one spiritual dimension to a different spiritual dimension, when he goes from a spiritual dimension into a physical dimension, and the physical dimension says, we're physical, but we know that we're completely and totally dependent on you, and you're fully present. We get this distinction, yes? More or less? Yes, this is the distinction. This is what they said. This is what Joshua and Caleb said. Tova ha'aretz ma'od ma'od. The land, the earth, the physical reality is exceedingly good. Yes, it's wonderful to bring light into heaven. But you know where it's exceedingly good? Down here in this physical world. That's where the real magic takes place. Yeah. Interesting reasons why. We know that, without taking away from them, but each of them had Joshua was blessed by Moshe before they went in. His name was Hosea before. Moshe added a letter to his name. He added God's name into his name. It says that Caleb went to, when they arrived in Israel, he went to Hebron. He went to Hebron to pray at the grave sites of our forefathers and mothers. So he drew strength from there. He knew that they were going to be challenged. It's very tempting. By the way, the spies, their world perspective is very tempting, as we articulated before. It's easy when you kind of lay out a case. Good lawyers don't get caught up in the emotions, but we're humans. Lawyers are also humans, some would argue, whatever. But we get caught up in the feeling, right? So I'm going to make a case. I did make a case before for the spies, right? For living in a spiritual cocoon. The excitement of being disconnected from the physical reality. It's very tempting. It's very good. I mean, like I said, Shabbos is awesome. I mean, if you can take this picture, okay? It's Shabbos morning. I mean, I don't know if you can get this, but I'll try to convey this. My wife's grandfather was a big chassid, a great chassid. His name was Rabbi Avram Mayar. And he used to daven for hours, hours and hours. And so on a Shabbos, late morning, early afternoon, when most of the crowd is already done and gone home, you could see him standing in 770 in the Rebbe's shul, standing there and just davening and davening and davening, singing songs, you know, singing nigunim and saying the words and stopping to think and to pray. Man was in heaven. He was on earth, but he was in heaven. I mean, it's Shabbos. There's no distractions. There's nothing to do, right? I mean, if we do it right, even if we do it a little bit right, come to shul on Shabbos after a Friday night, wonderful Shabbos meal with family. You come to shul Shabbos morning, you have your coffee and your cake, you do a little chassidus, right? And then you start davening. But maybe sometimes in a congregation, it's not as juicy because you gotta get through the service, but take your own time, even take 5 minutes, 10 minutes on a Shabbos morning and take one of the passages of the prayer and read it slowly, think about it, connect with it. I mean, there's no greater pleasure than that. Yeah, it might feel good when you win the battle during the week, when your coworker says something and you shut your mouth instead of responding, and you know, okay, I just did something big here. It doesn't feel so good. I mean, you feel like, okay, we have a little video of my nephew who's learning to ride a two-wheeler, and he finally gets it, and he says, I could do hard things, right? Yeah, it feels good to be able to do hard things. But bliss to stand and pray for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, and just be in that moment, disconnected from the world around them. I mean, that's delicious. It's like heaven. And that's what the spies wanted. And we understand it. They were just wrong. Because that's not this is not a personal journey of satisfaction or self-fulfillment. We're here to accomplish a mission. And that mission is ultimately accomplished when we face darkness, when we encounter darkness, and we push through it, and we say the darkness is not real, godliness is real. That's when we accomplish our mission for which the world was created. And the spies got that. Yehoshua and Caleb got that. Joshua and Caleb got that. They understood that. And they said, yes, the land consumes its inhabitants, but the land is exceedingly good. The same land that consumes its inhabitants is exceedingly good, meaning that it brings down the divine light not only into the heavenly experience, but also into the earthly experience. And that's where our purpose is fulfilled. Any questions, comments? How's this landing?
In a way, it's almost like they're dissing God. They're not really, that's pretty, you know, they're not holy. And somebody tells them, hey, you need to do this, make a little shift. They're holding you. That takes a lot of lift, right?
Yeah. So, So first of all, let's contextualize. They weren't commanded by God, they were commanded by Moses. Because actually, in these spies were not. Moshe asked Hashem if he should send spies, and Hashem said to him, "Shlach lecha, you send as you see fit. I'm not telling you what to do." But they didn't follow Moshe. In fact, your question is a core, just on a very technical level, on a what we call a pshat, on a basic level of the text. You see, Moses instructed them to do something, and they came back with a report. And you say, "Well, all they did was come back with a report. They did exactly what they were instructed to do." Had they come back and done what they were instructed to do, they would have said, this is the story. The lands, the cities are fortified. This is how tall the people are. These are the physical circumstances that we encountered. When they started giving interpretation, and they said it's a land that consumes its inhabitants, and they said this is a land that we cannot conquer, that this is a land that's stronger than even God, that's when they went wrong. They weren't instructed to give their opinion. They were instructed to come back with a report, which again is for us is a powerful message. the mission is articulated. Now, you don't want to do the mission? Fine. Don't do the mission. But don't pervert the mission, right, with your own stuff. The mission is to make the physical world a godly place. That's the mission. And it on every layer, on a physical level, on an emotional level, that's the mission. You're not up for the job? Fine. Go to your corner, be silent. But don't reinterpret the mission, right? That's what happens, is we're uncomfortable with what it is, so we give a new interpretation to it. They were uncomfortable with it, so they said, we'll do the same thing, we're going to do it in heaven. But that's not what you were instructed to do. The mission is not in heaven, the mission is down here. If the mission was in heaven, we would still be in heaven. It put us down here because this is where the mission's at.
It's interesting to me that in the current world of Spidem, real Spidem, he never attempt even decide to give the information to go directly to the requesting party. He would never attempt to analyze the visual manifold here.
Right, right. And that's, you know, I'm reading a book right now about targeted Israeli assassinations over the years. And what it's a very complex and controversial book, but what's really fascinating is this idea is, like, we sit here, we have all kinds of opinions. We don't know what really goes on behind the scenes, right? You know, how much training goes into any one of these spies, any one of these assassins, like how much training they go through. And it's not just like how to shoot a gun. You know, it's like it's internal training. It's complex, right? So as we learn more Torah and as we do more mitzvahs and as I mentioned before, as we become more and more refined, we have the capacity to tap in on a very subtle level to, you know, we can have that experience when we overcome a challenge, when we overcome a temptation, and we say, you know what, God's present here. This is God speaking. We can have a feeling for a moment of, yes, I brought godliness into the world. I brought godliness into this experience. It's a very powerful feeling. But don't let it get to your head. You haven't become a master of anything, right? This is our life's journey. And we're going to be doing, that's why one of the things that we're also plagued with today in our times is this notion of perfection. Everybody thinks that they're going to achieve perfection. There's no such thing. There's no such thing as perfection. Excellence. You fail, you succeed, you do it better next time, right? Why? Because that's our job. Our job is to keep on digging and to keep on working through to bring godliness into this world. That's our job and our challenge. So there's no mastery of this. It's a lifelong journey. Any other questions, comments? All right, let's continue. Now the Alter Rebbe is going to dig a little deeper into why it is, on some levels, why it is that it's specifically down here, it's specifically through the darkness that the greatest light is manifest. So he says, Ki be'emes kol shu madrega yeser gevoya mo'id mizgala b'davar ha'yeser tachtin dafka b'yeser seis. It's really to your point that you just said, Anne, that when we look at the world, we see low. We are in the low space, right? So what we can see is low. We see physicality. We see negativity. We see the human condition. And we say, look at these people. People, we're people. We're such foolish, frail, you know, we're just people with all of our mishagas, all of our craziness. Angels, souls in heaven, that's the real game. So you got it wrong. It's not how it works. The higher something originates, the lower it falls. Diamonds are found in the earth. They're not found on trees. The more difficult it is to access it, the more difficult it is to find it, the more valuable it is. If it's so valuable, why isn't it readily available? Precisely. Because it's so valuable, it's not readily available. If there's divine revelation, you know God's close by. You know that revelation is close by. When there's darkness, that's an indication that there's such a powerful light that the only way it can show up is if it's hidden. That's why a secret is a secret. Because it's so valuable, you can't just say it, you can't just expose it. You got to keep it on the low down. It's powerful. So the higher something originates, the lower it falls, the lower it manifests. Ulamashal, by way of analogy, mi barsecho gadol, a great intellectual, a great scholar, someone with great wisdom. Sometimes something is so profound that you can't actually articulate it in a straightforward manner. It could only be taught, could only be indicated through a hint. Like our sages say, "Dai l'chakima beremiza." For a wise person, it's sufficient to just use a hint. Sometimes people have like, and we can use your spidum example, right? Two spies, they have to interact with each other, but they contain serious information, so they have a passcode. They transmit the information with a passcode or a password. They don't give all the information because it's too potent. All you have is a password. Sometimes it's just a hint. A hint is enough to convey the depths of something. And in fact, the hint is the only way to convey it. Oid mashal, another analogy, the Alter Rebbe says, Michaisim shel evan toiv bahir, from the seal of a precious stone. In other words, in the olden days, you used to have, right, you used to seal a letter or you seal a document with a signet ring. Now, let's say that signet ring is made out of a beautiful, precious stone. Here in the translation, he says diamond. I don't know. Evan Tov just means a precious, you know, a good stone, but maybe it is diamond. I don't know. Whatever the case is. Shal yidei behirusei einin mikarim ha'isyus bay. So a really pure stone. And has letters engraved in it. You can't see the letters shining too brightly. How do you see the letters? When you take that stone and you press it into wax, now you can see the letters. You can't see it when it's in its source. It's only when it becomes manifest in a physical piece of wax. That's when you truly see the letters. So in the same way, the concealment in the physical world contains within it the greatest revelation, the highest light. Even if we don't see it, even if we don't experience it, it's not because it's not there. It's because it's too intense for us to experience. The tzaddik who's refined is able to tap into it. We who are not at that level, we can't experience it. We couldn't contain it. This is the meaning of the verse that we recite in the third chapter of the Shema, and you will see it. Well, you will see the tzitzis, right? So we have a four-cornered garment that has the tzitzis, 32 strings on the corners. Each corner has 8 strings. So 32 strings on the corners of our tzitzis, of our garments. So it says, and you will see the 32 strings, you'll see the tzitzis, uzchartem es kol mitzvos Hashem, and you will recall all of the commandments of Hashem. What does that mean? Shayidei maisa. Through a physical action of looking at the tzitzis, we come to remember the commandments of Hashem. Why? the talus, the tzitzis, right? Talus. Everybody's familiar with the talus, right? A talus is a garment, and we regular talus we wrap around our body. A talus katan, the small tzitzis, we place over our body, but it's also around our body. And then on the corners, the four corners of the garment, we have the strings. So in Kabbalah, in the teachings of Jewish mysticism, the idea of the wrapping of the talus represents what's called an or makif, an encompassing light. What's the difference between an encompassing light and an internal light? In order for light to go internally, it needs to contend with the recipient. If you want it to go in, you gotta make sure that it's measured to fit. So if I want water to go into this cup, number one, I got to take it from a source that's going to channel it. It may be a big tank of water, but if I pour the thing like that, I'm going to make a big mess. And it's not going to, sometimes you can do that where you take like a whole thing and you turn it over and you may end up with water in your cup, but you're not going to end up with a full cup because it itself splashes some of it out, right? If you want to fill up a cup, you take it from a thing with a spigot and you slowly fill it up and you get to the top. So there has to be a relationship that the source is contending with the recipient and it channels it that way. Same thing intellectually. If you want to share an idea, you have to channel the idea that you're thinking about into words, which themselves are containers, on a level that the recipient can comprehend. If I speak Chinese and you don't speak Chinese, we're not going to go anywhere, right? It's got to be the right type of vessel. And even if we all speak English and we're using English to communicate, if I don't use words that make sense to you, that can relate to you, you're not going to get it. Even then, sometimes you don't get it. So it has to be channeled. But an or makif, an encompassing light, doesn't take into consideration the recipient. It's there to shine, right? There's a concept of love languages. Five love languages, right? Familiar with it? I see younger people are shaking their heads. Older people are saying, I don't know what you're talking about. So five love languages, I forget the author of the book, but it's not the only great guidance in life, but it helps frame an idea. What's the idea? The idea is that I love you and I want to show you love. What do I know about love? I know love, how I experience love. So I show up and I bring you a big gift. And you say, thank you, appreciate that. Didn't land particularly well. Why? Because your love language is not gift giving or gift receiving. Your love language is words of affirmation. So yes, I brought you this nice gift, but had I said to you, you know, sweetheart, you're so amazing. You worked so hard this week. I'm so grateful to you. You're just such a wonderful person. Whatever your spouse needs. That would be much more valuable to her than a gift. Why? Because that's what she appreciates. Or if your spouse's love language is spending time, you're going to go bring her a big expensive gift and she says, keep your gift. I just want to go hang out with you for an hour. Right? Just give me an hour of your time. So there's these five love languages. What's the point? The point is if I show up with my heart open because I want to express love, I know you need love, so I'm here to give you my love. It's big. It's overflowing. My heart's wide open. But it's not what you need. It's not that you're going to be upset at me that I showed love. It's just not going to go in. It's just not going to be internalized because it's not your language. So you can have a great professor who gets up to give a lecture and could care less who's in the room. And they talk and talk and talk. And there's a lot of light coming out. It's not going anywhere. It doesn't mean that it doesn't go anywhere. In other words, the experience is, wow, that realm of thought is very, very profound. I can't do anything with it, but I'm definitely in awe, right? You definitely get the experience, but you don't go home with anything. So in the divine revelation, we have two types of revelation. And by the way, there's an advantage to each. At Mount Sinai, there was a revelation of Makif. There was a revelation of this encompassing light. It was very powerful. It became the foundation for our faith. But the souls left their bodies. They couldn't contain it. It couldn't go in. It was too intense for them to go in. And they were able to worship a golden calf 40 days later because it didn't go in. They were in awe. Yeah, God, you're great. You're amazing. You're real. But it's removed from me. It's not my God. And then subsequently, after the sin of the golden calf, over the next 40 years while they were in the desert, the Torah was taught to them slowly. They internalized it, which is why, coming full circle, the spies made a big mistake. They lacked that, and ultimately, as a result, that generation, they lacked the recognition that all of this light that was internalized needs to translate down into the most physical of things. The point being is that the greatest light comes down, has to be translated down in the very physical. So the Alter Rebbe uses this verse about the Shema. He says, and you will see the tzitzis. You'll see the tzitzis. You're going to see this great light, but you're going to see. So first of all, there's an action item there, right? The action item takes the encompassing light of the talis garment. What are you looking at? It doesn't say to look at the garment. It says, look at the tzitzis. In other words, it's the action of looking that translates the energy of the talis to the strings. It channels them in a way that now we can access them. That's our job. Our job is to take action. And in the act of taking action, we access the divine light that's hidden. The big encompassing light that's out there is accessed, not out there. The encompassing light is accessed through here, through the simple physical action. Through the act of a mitzvah, that's how we access that powerful light that stems, that originates all the way there. It's accessed on the most basic physical mitzvah. That's where we get it. That's where the spies got it wrong. And that's where Joshua and Caleb got it right, that the land itself, the physical land of Israel, is exceedingly good. That's where we make the real connection. In the physical reality of this world is where our connection with God takes place. Questions? Yeah, I'm not, there's a lot of discourses on it. Nothing specifically jumping out at me. Other questions? Yes. The people approached Moshe. It wasn't specifically the spies. The people approached Moshe and they said, you know, how are we gonna go up and conquer the land? Let's take it on a basic level. Let's say they didn't know. The problem was when the spies came forward and gave their report, considering the spiritual messaging in their report, the people accepted it. The people accepted the premise instead of protesting it and saying, you're not listening to Moshe. The people should have said, we don't care what you're saying. Moshe said, God told us we can conquer this land. God told us that, yes, this is not necessarily the most pleasant mission. I don't want to draw an exact parallel because, number one, I don't want to create any tension. But it's something I've been thinking a lot about, that Israel, I just saw this morning, there's this whole notion of various different countries coming together to declare unilaterally a Palestinian state. And Israel's saying, the Knesset voted, the cabinet voted to reject that premise. Nobody's going to force us to accept what you say. it's the Jewish people have found their voice. Hopefully they can keep their voice. Jewish leaders have found their voice. No one should tell anybody what to do. This is our land. God gave it to us. We're going to protect it. We're going to defend it. We get to decide what, if, how, when. It's our place. It's not yours. Don't gather in Riyadh or wherever else you're gathering and tell us what to do. That should have been the people's response to the spies. You got a job. You came back. You told us about the land. Now go home. God told us we can conquer it. We will conquer it. How? I don't know. What's it going to look like? I don't know. That's our job. God told us that a mitzvah takes place in the physical world. That's what we have to do. It's not so exciting. You're not playing with divine light and energy, right? It's not a light show. Okay, so be it. You weren't instructed to go play in a light show. God told you, go take the piece of challah, make a bracha on it, and eat it. God told you to take that coin and put it in the tzedakah box. But how is this holy? It's just a physical dollar bill. How did that become holy? Exactly. Because that's what God told you to do, and that's where it takes place. The people should have responded. The fact that they didn't was because they were still of an exile mentality. They still fell in line with the wrong crowd. Instead of having gotten the message from Sinai that God is in control, God is in charge. And again, I don't mean to diss those people because we struggle with the same thing, right? Every time we're faced with a choice and a challenge, we internally struggle. Yes, I know God's speaking to me. Yes, God's inside there and God's telling me that this is the way to approach it. But it doesn't feel so good. It's not so exciting. I'd rather do this. So we're in the same struggle. But we got a little more information than they did. And that is that it doesn't work that way. That's not the job. That's not where it takes place. It takes place in the physical, in the struggle, in the victory, in the increasing of light from darkness. That's where it takes place.